Welcome to the Standard Deviations Podcast, presented by Orion Advisor Solutions and hosted by Dr. Daniel Crosby, Orion's Chief Behavioral Officer and New York Times best-selling author. Each week, Dr. Crosby interviews a fascinating new guest on a range of compelling topics, from literature to psychology to financial wellness. To learn more about Dr. Crosby's behavioral finance work at Orion, visit www.orion.com.
Hello, listeners. Before we get started this week, I want to tell you about an exciting new development that we've been working on at Orion. If you go to orion.com/behavioral-finance, you will get access to a white paper and more information about a new risk tolerance questionnaire that we've developed that incorporates elements of behavioral finance into it. That's orion.com/behavioral-finance. Thanks and enjoy this week's episode. Hello and welcome to Standard Deviations. I'm your host, Dr. Daniel Crosby. I am joined today by Jeff Kreisler, head of behavioral science at JP Morgan, founding editor of peoplescience.com, and co-author with none other than Dan Ariely of Dollars and Cents, a great book about the psychology of money. Welcome, sir.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, so I find one of the most boring ways to start a podcast is tell me about your professional career, right? Like I do a lot of podcasts and people are like, tell me about your professional path. And I'm always like, really? Like, is this the best you could do? But in your case, I'm going to ask because you're an Ivy League educated lawyer turned comedian, turned behavioral scientist. And that is a story worth hearing. So how did you get to where you are today from where you started?
It's a great question. And full disclosure, I only go on podcasts because it's cheaper than hiring a therapist because I get to relive my past. So I'll try to give you and your listeners and hello, everyone. Thanks for tuning in. The short version, I went to college and studied economics there and politics and into law school. And at law school, I was a little delusional about what that meant. I wanted to be Thurgood Marshall or Thomas Jefferson, change the world. And that's not really what the practice of law is. I love the school. I love studying. It didn't stick for me. And basically, after law school, I moved to California, took the bar out there because, you know, checked the box and started doing stand-up comedy. And my comedy was kind of about politics, but it was largely about like human hypocrisy, human, the way people's tricked or manipulated each other, the things that, you know, from behavioral science perspective later on, of course, I recognize the through line, but it was, you know, political hypocrisy, cheating, stuff like that. I got an opportunity to write for Jim Cramer's website, thestreet.com. A friend of mine said, hey, he was an editor there, said, hey, do you want to write a weekly humor column about the news and business? And I said, no. And he said, it pays. I said, yes. And through that, then I sort of re-dug into the world of business and finance and money, got an opportunity to write my first book out of that column, which was a satire. I want to be clear, satire called Get Rich Cheating. And it was, you know, Stephen Colbert meets Tony Robbins meets Jim Cramer, you know, how to be Enron, how to be Lance Armstrong, how to be, you know, a Hollywood star. And It was so much fun to write. And then I also made it into a touring show. I got on air in character on MSNBC, believe it or not. I was on a show there, a regular character, you know, this satirical, you should cheat. What's the big deal? And it was a lot of fun. And then, you know, things accelerated and sort of landed me here when Dan Ariely read the book and invited me to come speak to his class at Duke. And I did it in character. He didn't say it was a joke. He just said, here's someone with some unique wealth ideas. And I came out in my whole, like, you know, you shouldn't have morals. You shouldn't have ethics, cost benefit analysis. You know, the cost, no one gets caught, but you might make millions. You should cheat. Hooray. And it was just a fascinating experience on a lot of levels, A is seeing which students agreed with me. But the real key for me was discovering Dan and the field of behavioral science and behavioral economics. And, you know, it's something that just wasn't there when I was in college and it wasn't an opportunity. And it was a light bulb moment for me because I think my rejection of practicing law and rejection of sort of practicing economics, if you will, was that like, yeah, here are these rules that maybe work on a macro level, but like, that's not how humans interact. Like, humans are fooled by themselves and by others. And I learned about Dan's work and his field, and we ended up writing a book that came out 2017, Dollars and Cents, all about financial decision making. And at that point, I had sort of, not an evangelical, what's the word? Like, I just really wanted to spread the word of behavioral science as not a silver bullet, but an additional tool for people and organizations and communities. I'm about to stick the landing, get where we are. I got an opportunity to do two things then. One was speaking and consulting around behavioral science, usually about financial decision making, and then to run peoplescience.com, which was this platform for talking about behavioral science, largely not about finances, more about like engagement, incentives, design, experiences. And they were both great. Both of those things were wonderful opportunities. I learned more. I met more people in the field. It's an emerging field, as you well know. And then last year, this opportunity at JP Morgan came along. And, you know, with the reach of JP Morgan and the potential here to impact financial decision making at such a huge scale and hopefully improve people's lives a little bit, I just, you know, figured, why not? Let's give it a shot. And we're building that up and we'll see. So that was longer than a minute and a half, but.
No, but an incredible journey. Incredible journey. Thank you for breaking it down for us. So I have now had the opportunity to see two of my friends do stand-up comedy at open mic nights. Now, mm-hmm. I consider these two guys some of the funniest people I know. They're hilarious online. They're very quick-witted in conversation. And hopefully they're not listening because they were just terrible. I mean, they were just terrible live. And it really gave me a lot of respect for sort of the art and craft of doing stand-up. What did you learn as a comedian that translates well into your work as a behavioral scientist?
That's a great question. And there are three thoughts that come to mind. First is that I think that looking back, I see a through line in my career, which is that, you know, stand-up comedian like a Jerry Seinfeld says, hey, did you ever notice people do this stupid thing? Mm-hmm. And the behavioral scientist says, yeah, this is why. So mm-hmm. there is a through line of both sort of observing human behavior, right? One is to make a joke. The other is to explain that behavior. Another element that even ties in my work as a lawyer, which was really study, is I think all three of them will look at a situation and try to break it down to its elements to then retell a story about that situation, right? A lawyer looks at a car accident, gets all the facts and data, figures out how they can tell that story from their client's perspective. Right? A comedian looks at something that happens and breaks down what's going on and tries to tell that story with the goal of getting a laugh or making a... And a behavioral scientist probably like looks at a situation, breaks down all its elements and figures out, okay, what are the points where I can experiment here? How like tiny in detail can I get to see what impact things have? And then let's tell the story of that. But honestly, one of the things, the biggest thing that happens, and your friends will learn this if they stick to it, is the idea of like experimentation and iteration. You know, nobody walks on stage the first time as a comedian is any good. Mm-hmm. Everybody bombs. Everybody fails. Like people at the top of their game bomb all the time. I've seen Robin Williams have a bad set, believe it or not. I mean, he knows how to get out of it, but the point being, you walk on stage with a brilliant idea and you test it out in front of an audience. And, you know, some people have a rule, like you try a joke three times, if it doesn't work, you scrap it. Others, it's just a feel thing, but you iterate and you grow your ideas, and some of them work and some of you toss out. And, you know, it's not a one-to-one correlation to like, you know, a scientific approach to experimentation, but there's a similarity there. It's like you take the sum of your knowledge and experience and you think this is what's happening, but then you have to go try it out and sink or swim. So that's my lesson.
So staying with this theme of comedy, I watch a lot of comedy and I consider myself sort of an armchair comedy quarterback. And one of the things that I've noticed is that two comedians can tell a joke with similar content with mm-hmm. respect to, say, offensiveness. And one person, it lands, right? You sort of see, for whatever reason, the good heart behind the ostensibly offensive comment. And mm-hmm. then the other person, it's just like a car crash, right? It's just, it's so caustic. What is that je ne sais quoi, right? Like, what is that? What is that thing underneath there that makes you feel the authenticity or the spirit behind it? Were you ever able to decipher that in your own comedy?
Yes, I think I was able to. Of course, you know, many, many years later, it's why comedy takes, it's not an overnight thing. It's about personality. It's about being comfortable with who you are on stage and being, you know, it's a hot term, but authentic and genuine. And even if you are a character, right? Even if it's not actually who Jeff Chrysler is, it's Jeff Chrysler, like being true to that and having depth to that so that in every moment, the audience recognizes like, this is who this person is. You know, when you're on a stand-up stage and you're talking for 45 minutes or even for 5 minutes, like people are staring at you, the person, there's no props, there's no other actors, and they will decipher something's not, is a disconnect and not genuine. And like when it comes to offensive material, they will understand, like if you presenting yourself as this guy for, I forget what the phrase was you used, but like who this is like a joke, like, or if it's like, oh, this guy actually is a jerk, right? He actually thinks he's different. Like people will pick up on that. So ultimately it becomes about comfort in who you are and what you're doing. And some of that is the editing process of like, you know, you gotta talk, like you can write a joke that's hilarious, but if it doesn't work for your act, for who you are, you throw it away. Maybe you give it to a friend, right? Mm-hmm. But it's ultimately, it's about just like years of getting on stage and seeing what is real about you and what, you know, resonates with the audience. You know, there's also other factors, like some audiences, just, you know, a church group is not the same as a bike rally. You know, West Virginia is not the same as a theater in upstate New York. So there are other variables, but ultimately what I've seen is it comes down to, you know, how real is what you do to who you are.
Before we move on from the comedy portion of our conversation here, I just want to ask you, who's your favorite comedian these days? Who are you watching and loving these days?
You know, there's a woman, Blair Erskine, who does a lot of video blogs.
Hilarious.
Yeah. So she's great. Of this sort of era, this Zoom era, she might be one of my favorites. She's very satirical, right? She takes down these characters. Sometimes people don't know what's real. You know, stand-up wise, I still sort of the classics. I could still listen to George Carlin and it's still relevant. You know, Bill Hicks is someone I actually am proud to have won an award named after him, but it's a little more dated. But like if I can transport into that time when he was there, it's great. You know, I haven't been as caught up in the latest as I used to be. Like I'm now sort of more enjoying the different formats that's gone beyond, like Amy Schumer's show. Like Amy Schumer's stand-up to me is good. Her show was, I thought, groundbreaking and fantastic. So Dave Chappelle is still great.
Yeah.
I mean, I could go on and on, but
I don't know if you've watched any of the Bo Burnham specials. Those absolutely blew me away. Make Happy.
On my list for this weekend is displayed.
Make Happy is the most incredible show I've ever seen. And yeah. His new one, I think it's called Inside, was really sort of a fantastic send-up of life under quarantine. So really the most unique comedian and like an incredibly talented musician who just weaves that into his show. So let's move from comedy a bit now and let's get to your book because it's a great book. One of my favorite quotes from your book is, thinking a lot about money would be fine if by thinking more about it, we were able to make better decisions. So what do you mean by this? It would be fine if by thinking more about it, we're able to make better decisions.
I can kind of remember the genesis of this line coming out of my life experience as much as it was from our research. And just the idea of like, you can overthink things and you can overthink things and get yourself into like a mental spiral and just get in your own way. And when it comes to financial decision-making, like it is, financial decision-making is an emotional process. There are things that like you can't think your way through. And maybe again, this is my therapy session. You know, how you think and how you feel are two different things. And you know, sometimes people get so tight on budgeting or so tight on laying out a specific like framework that they lose sight of why they're making these financial decisions in the first place. And it gets muddled. So there's that one level of just sort of getting in your way. The other aspect is that we know in all decision-making that, you know, we have the system one and system two way of thinking. I'm sure your listeners are familiar with, and the automatic and the thoughtful is how I like to refer to them. And most of our decisions go on the automatic. And if we can't try to force ourselves to suddenly become deep and thoughtful about every decision, every time we want to get a latte, to stop and think, how does this impact my retirement savings? Every time we go shopping to think about, you know, are organic tomatoes worth 10 cents more a pound? Every time we, et cetera, like we can't be that thoughtful. So we want to instead put things on automatic, like do whatever way, make it so that we are in systems and with frameworks and tools so that we by default make the best decisions for us. And whether that's particularly personalized ways of spending or the type of apps that we use for certain, this is my discretionary money I pay with this card and this is whatever the system personalized, or it's bigger things like using automatic payment into your 401k, like automatic withdrawal is you know, groundbreaking. The idea of using a default bias, like instead of every paycheck, I'm faced with thinking, oh, is this the right, I should put aside this money and like making myself challenged and stressed about it. Instead, I've made one decision and every week that money just goes to a good place for me. If we can make our financial lives all automatic, but all the decisions being for our own benefit, right? Not automatic spending, but that would just be so much more beneficial to us than to have to constantly be stressed and thinking about it. Because what we often find is when we start just thinking about stuff too much, it almost heightens our stress. And that stress and that uncertainty, that's the cause of the irrationality to start with. And if we just flood more of that into the zone, then it's like we're almost more inclined to make the poor decision. You know, some people, that's how they operate. And again, you know, none of the stuff in this field is like a one size fit all. Some people are super type A, love a spreadsheet, and that provides them joy. Great. But I think most people spending time on every decision would not necessarily lead to better choices.
Yeah. What's the Kahneman quote? Nothing is important as you think it is while you're thinking about it, like that exactly. Sort of thing. And, you know, I'm always, this sounds weird for a guy who writes books about money for a living, but I'm always kind of disappointed when people think about this stuff too much and like sort of ask me very granular, detailed questions. I'm always like, oh, come on, guys, like let's put yourself in good situations, automate your financial life, and then go do the stuff that matters. Like, right. Go be a better person. Go spend time with your kids. Go like do, there's 1,000 things that matter more than trying to wring an extra 1% of alpha out of your portfolio or an extra 1% of tax savings and, you know, designing where you live around the taxes, just like all of it, you know, get the basics right, get the big rocks right, and then move on, because thinking about it distracts you from more important stuff and B doesn't always help very much. Yeah.
Absolutely. I mean, there are two things that in what you said just resonated with me. One is that my long-term delusional goal outside of my current role is kind of along those lines. I get people to like recognize the value of other things in life and what matters. And I'm not saying that's a revolutionary idea, but just, and the other thing is what I found a lot in previous roles before this is the advice I would give that I think probably help people the most because they say so is we tend to focus a lot on the little decisions and not so much on the big ones. Like we obsess over shopping at the grocery store and those things. But like when we buy a house, we sort of like poo-poo an extra $10,000 and, you know, whatever. Like worry about the big decisions. Those are the ones to spend a lot of time on. Don't worry about the little, you know, $1.50 here. And I think for a lot of people, it tends to be reversed because like the buying a house or buying a car is so like foreign, like you kind of throw up your hands at some point. Mm-hmm. And I think that like it's just on a financial level, it's going to have more impact of stress once every 10 years or once every 3 years, or even, you know, revisit the automatic decisions once a year than like every day worry about this.
Yeah. Less cutting coupons and driving to Costco to save 10 cents on gas, more, you know, college, cars, and house. Like if you get those three things right, you've got a lot. That's you're halfway there, really.
A lot of gas tanks of gas.
Yes, that's right. So the book talks a lot about the pain of paying. So if you would just kind of explain to the listeners, what is the pain of paying? How do companies use that against us? And how can we sort of take the power back, if you will?
The pain of paying is like my favorite sort of all the biases or principles, nudges, whatever term of art that I came across. It's this idea that when we pay for something, it stimulates the same region of our brain as pain does. It doesn't cause us physical pain, but it's very similar. And if listeners, you know, can picture themselves somewhere handing over a $20 bill, they'll recognize there's a little like tug. There's a little pain there. Now, from my perspective, as I thought about, you know, pain serves an evolutionary purpose, right? Pain is supposed to make us pay attention to what we're doing and heal or make a different choice. You can put your hand on a stove, that burn makes you look at your hand and say, oh, I should move it, right? You break your leg, that pain makes you look at your leg and I get to the hospital, et cetera. The challenge is that we humans, we tend not to like pain. So we tend to find things that numb the pain rather than feeling it, we numb it. You know, forgive me, but you open the comedy, you'd open this with comedy. So I'll see, like Jerry Seinfeld has a routine about how they invented helmets. That's basically people were doing all these things that were cracking open their heads. And instead of stopping the head cracking activities, they just put on a little piece of plastic, right? They just numb them instead of doing, and it's sort of the same with us, right? Instead of like feeling the pain of paying, we use a credit card, which is a little piece of plastic. And you know, it's a lot of the ways I approach financial decision-making talking about is in the negative, like what we're doing wrong. And so I'll preface if I don't get to it with saying there's ways to use this to our benefit, but credit cards numb the pain of paying, you know, Apple Pay and facial recognition and automatic bill pay, all of that numbs the pain of pain. It makes it so we don't feel it. We don't stop and think. We don't do the equivalent of looking at a hand on a stove. We just buy because it's so easy and it's presented, it's gone. Like there's that commercial, I remember this guy, it's like walking through a marketplace with his Apple phone and he like sees a hat out of the corner of his eye. Then he like looks and does facial recognition on his phone and then the hat pops on his head. Like it's fun and easy. And yes, it is easy, but that means you're just going to keep spending thoughtlessly. And you know, when you're not aware, when you don't feel the pain of paying, you don't stop and think about it. And you know, we just said don't obsess about money and put things on automatic. That's great. And again, one way the pain of paying, reducing that can be used positive is for 401k withdrawal, for things that you really want to make automatic with your money. It's wonderful. But like just consumptive, if that's a word, consumption spending, making it easy is not great. And you know, for the dorks a little bit like myself, the two sort of elements of pain of paying are time, right? The time between we find when you consume something and you pay for it, the more time there is, the less aware you are of less thoughtful that consumption is because it's push off in the future. Or even if like you prepay for something, when you then consume it, you consume it actually with more pleasure because there isn't like an overhang in pain of paying. So the time matters as well as just the salience, like literally how aware you are of pain. Mm-hmm. That's why they say for people with a lot of like issues with like discretionary spending, people sometimes give the advice, you know, spend a month and just use cash, right? That's not practical for your life, but suddenly you're going to be aware of all of your choices a lot more than if you put that on, you know, just on your phone app or checks or credit cards, et cetera. So it's a fascinating thing. And I, in many ways, like Acorns is, I was trying to think of the name, like Acorns is an app that uses the pain of paying, I think in a good way, right? You set a savings goal and they automatically take, what are they? I think they like round up to the dollar of every purchase. So it can be dialed up or down. For me, the first step is being aware that it's at play with our decisions, big and small consumption, and also, you know, savings and investing. If you think about investing, it's a lot of pain right now, like you're putting aside chunks of money for a payoff that's in the far distant future. And so it's hard for people to make investment and saving decisions because all they feel is that pain. They don't get the good stuff. So finding a way to work within that will help us all.
Yeah. You know, I think about probably the biggest detriment to my own financial life is the fact that my credit cards are all stored on my computer. So anytime I go navigate to a site and I want to buy something, it's extremely easy, right? So the time is deferred because you pay the credit card in a month or whatever. And then it's low salience because there's nothing that I have to do to make it happen. Like it's all right there. Automation can work for you or against you. Salience.
Amazon is a great, sorry to interrupt, but like Amazon, I can't remember if it was their first patent, but like the one click technology of Amazon is a, you know, great behavioral science on their part, bad for the consumer, but you just, boop, you hit a button and it's free shipping that you paid $100 a year for, whisper, whisper.
Right.
So like, you know, Amazon has harnessed a lot of the reducing the pain of paying to make, you know, their success.
Well, and if you go to order any kind of toiletries or, you know, vitamins or anything, it defaults to multiple shipments, right? It defaults to monthly recurring shipments. they're trying to use automaticity against you in the same way that your 401k automated process works for you. Yeah. Yep. There's lots of good nudges and there's plenty of sludge, as Thaler and the gang call it.
Yeah.
So you also talk about Ulysses contracts. This is of course from the myth of Ulysses. Tell us about the story of Ulysses and how he sort of used pre-commitment to avoid a sticky situation, and then how practically we can use that to make better financial decisions.
So Ulysses was, in this case, the guy that wanted to listen to the sirens sing as he sailed by, but the sirens, I can't remember where it was, in Sirenville. they were so tempting and alluring that any sailor and his boat would crash into the rock because they chased after the sirens. So he wanted to hear the song, but he didn't want to crash. So he had his crew bind him to the mast of his boat and had them all stuff their ears and instructed them to, under no circumstance, let him free, because he knew that he would do anything to get free and give into that temptation. And all I can think of now is the Simpsons version of this tale. So I don't remember exactly how it ended. Basically, the idea was he wasn't going to crash. I don't think he crashed. I think he made it past. It was part of a wonderful journey that ended up with him at either Hogwarts or the Death Star.
Yeah.
This is not my classical literature podcast. So the idea there, and one thing that we can use, is very simply like finding a way to prevent us from giving into temptation. The biggest challenge I found in all financial decision-making and all decision-making really is the issue of self-control. The fact that even when we know what the right thing is to do, we give into temptation all the time. Mm-hmm. You know, there are a lot of cool studies about why this is. One of my favorites is that, you know, we think of our future selves as different people than us. Mm. We're not emotionally connected to the future. We're not emotionally connected to the consequences of our decision, whereas we are emotionally connected to the temptation of the present. Like what feels good right now, you know, eating some chocolate cake when we want to lose weight for 3 years from now, mm-hmm. not saving when we, you know, and spending it on something, not exercising when we should, like that, the stuff that's right now feels going after the sirens because they feel and sound so good right now, even though we know it'll help us, we'll crash, but we don't care. So with that in mind, like finding ways to commit yourself to a goal is a way to overcome our lack of self-control. You know, I get very bristly when people, I see articles about, you know, you just got to have more self-control, right? You just got to like dedicate. Like if you just got up every day at 8 and wrote 20 pages, you'd have your book done, or what if you just have more people that are very, you know, I say macho, it's unfair to put that on it, but for lack of a better word, like it's not about changing our lack of, like, it's just human nature to not have this self-control. So instead, put in systems, put in mechanisms that prevent you from making that mistake. Again, I'll fall back on the 401k default payment. Like it's brilliant in its simplicity. Like I'm not faced every paycheck with a choice to use, you know, whatever hundreds of dollars, either for my future self or for my present self. Because if I was, even me, having written a book on it, I would spend that money now, right? I would do something else. So I've committed myself to doing it. You know, it's not quite as much as sailor's life. Like I could get out of it. And the level of like how committed you are is different. There's an app, I think it's called, or a website called Stick. Mm-hmm. And don't they, correct me if I'm wrong, but the idea is basically like you make a commitment to a goal, and if you break it, they will donate money to a cause that you hate.
Right. That's right. Yep.
And that's a great way to trigger a lot of different psychological issues to make you stick to your goal. So, you know, in lieu of trying to just force yourself to have more self-control, whether it's about finances or exercise or diet, making it so that you're committed to doing it. Public commitment tools or ways to prevent you from even touching money, and even stuff like, you know, certain trusts and more complex financial instruments that you literally cannot touch for X number of years or under circumstances, like that's ways to tie yourself to the mast. Mm-hmm. Like you stop. And when you're in that cool rational state, you're like, yes, it would benefit me to put X thousand dollars into this for whatever my kids' college, right? 529 or for my retirement or for my yacht, whatever your situation is. So let me put in something that I can't touch later. that I can't touch when I'm in a hot and emotional state. And I wish I had an extra 10 grand or a million or whatever your number is. I think that answered enough of the question. I can't believe how much I don't know about you. I got to remember what happened to him.
I was going to help fill you in. And then my Alabama public school education just failed me. So I'm no better than you. I'm no better than you, I'm afraid.
Let's pause there for also, in the reverse is true. My fancy pants Northeastern education also did. So for any of my peers who ever want to have a superiority complex, let me tell your listeners.
Yeah, perfect. Perfect. So we started our conversation with some talk of streamlining and simplicity. So let's end the conversation around the book in that same place. You talk in the book about getting rid of complicated budgets and in favor of a more streamlined, behaviorally informed approach. I feel, again, like a bit of a hypocrite. I hate budgeting. Every attempt at budgeting I've ever tried has been a massive failure, and like fast. Like within, you know, 10 days, 2 weeks, my budget's dead. And the thing that works for me and my family is we set savings goals and we set aggressive savings goals. And if we meet those savings goals, the rest is gravy, right? The rest you do whatever you want with. And that's the only thing that's ever worked for us. I don't know if that's behaviorally sound, but it's what works for us. Pay yourself first, pay yourself well. Set it aside, don't touch it. And then the rest is yours to spend. What are some simplified budgeting approaches, behaviorally informed budgeting approaches for people like me who just are that bad at it?
Well, I'm going to preface by saying there's no silver bullet that works for everyone. And there's a bit of, you got to sort of self-experiment, find out what works for you or identify what your issues are. Like, are you someone that spends too much on shoes or theater tickets? But anyway, so there's personalization. Broadly speaking, though, I think the more you can make it simple and automatic and force yourself into less decisions, the better. I am in favor of an approach that harnesses what, you know, what I would call mental accounting. The idea that like we think about money differently depending on the source or the use of it, right? Like we think about lottery winnings very differently than something from our job. We think about money that we're spending on a trip to Vegas very differently than money that we're putting aside for college savings. And like, that's irrational from the perspective of like, you know, homo economicus and the perfect preacher, money's fungible, beep, boop, boop, boop. But it's particularly useful to recognize and then build around. And one way that I've seen this work well is, you know, the idea of like creating goals and buckets around your finances, like getting, you don't have to get super granular, but like thinking about your money as, okay, this is a chunk of my money that's going to be used for my retirement. This is a chunk for my kids. This is a chunk for discretion and lifestyle and spending. This is a safety chunk, like breaking your money into sort of these buckets. And then within those, like you can operate focusing just on one without the stress of trying to think how everything else impact, right? Again, you don't want to go and worry about, is your latte going to affect your retirement? That's just too much to think about. But if you're in your, you know, let's say $1,000 a month of discretionary spending on theater and dinners and lattes, right? That's easier to handle. So the more you can break up into chunks, the better. And then, you know, there is the potential to then, like, your spillover idea, if you will, is great. Like if you hit your goal, right? Like every month I'm going to put X into savings, X into college, X into whatever. And this month I happen to make more, or I didn't spend as much on dinner. Then you can reward yourself. Mm-hmm. Like, tap into that. Like, don't, I want to make it, one of my delusions is making it so money is not this stressful, scary thing that we don't talk about money. Like no one, it's like forbidden thing. You know, everyone sees how much everyone spends. And we talk about how, you know, sometimes how much we earn, but we don't really talk about how money makes us feel. And so lean into the aspects of money that can be like emotionally rewarding. Like it can, like if you hit your savings goal on the 25th, if that's how you set it up, and you have a couple $100, go to dinner, spend it, mm-hmm. you know, buy, treat yourself, because that $200 is worth it to feel good. And that good feeling then will motivate you to hit your savings goal again next month, right? And the following month. And maybe it'll motivate you to save an extra $100 because you'll feel even better. And don't deny the emotions that come with savings and spending and planning. You know, to circle back to the start here, simplify, and automate and make it more about revisiting your goals and your plans than constant maintenance. And by that, I mean, like, you set up whatever your system is and let it run for 6 months or a year, and then just revisit it. Once in a while, set aside a money date, like, hey, honey, this is the, we're going to spend 2 hours going over this quarter, whatever, and just focus on that time. Don't try not to let it leak into everything you do.
Yeah.
That's just more about happy life than, you know, which, as I said, it's been cool. Make everyone happy.
Yeah. I like what you say about just kind of being kind to ourselves and just making, enjoying the journey a little bit. I mean, when you look at all the research around why New Year's resolutions fail, I think it's because we set these really draconian goals, right? Like, I'm going to go on a 2-week water fast, and like, that's how I'm going to get this off. Right. I mean, there's something to being slow and steady, celebrating small wins and being kind to yourself along the way. Final question about the book. I mean, you pulled off something that I think a lot of folks like me dream of. I mean, you co-authored a book with an absolute legend in the field. What did you learn from Dan Ariely? What did you, in your partnership with him, what did you observe from him that you're taking with you?
I would say the importance of kindness. Believe it or not, outside of the field of behavioral science, I have had the pleasure, like through comedy, to work with, you know, on project stars and successful people of all levels, you know, and the person who has been the most kind and generous has been the economics professor, right? Not the TV star, not the creator of XYZ show, and some of that may be an indictment of entertainment, but I think it's a statement about Dan, the importance of like being there and listening and providing opportunity and helping others. And that, as I said, obviously goes beyond, you know, the field of behavioral science and just in general. Like, there's no sense of competition. Dan is here to genuinely do what we're trying to do in the book and his other work, have people make better decisions. So being guided by a true vision, if you will, I've taken away from that. You know, also the importance, he set a very high standard for me. You know, when we would write the book, he wanted to make sure, and I also did, but he even more so, like, if we were representing a study out there, like, these are his peers, right? He doesn't want to misrepresent someone else's study because he knows they're probably going to read the book or they're going to hear about it. Like, he wants to make sure that, like, what we're saying is scientifically sound. Like, if the, earlier when I was talking about pain of paying, I used to say early on, paying for something it makes us feel pain. But he's like, no. It stimulates the same region of our brain as pain and et cetera. And just those that like the importance of being accurate with the science as much as possible, he really hammered home and not to overstate like what we can and cannot do here. This is not, you know, it's not input output, like immediate accurate. It's still like science and a bit of estimation with as much detail as we can. So kindness, importance of being scientifically accurate, also the importance of drinking wine. As you may notice, wine was a recurring theme and a recurring example in the book. I'm sure I can make up some reason why wine is behaviorally science important. It's long-term planning and language and blah, but it's a nice drink.
There's fun research around wine and behavioral finance. Thanks to Dan and others. Well, I've long been a fan of his work, but it sounds like I can be a fan of Dan Ariely the person as well. He sounds like a wonderful guy. So, last question. You and I, let's pat ourselves on the back here. You and I are one of just, you know, a couple of handfuls of sort of behavioral scientists, chief behavioral scientists, if you will, in financial organizations. What do you see as next for the field? Where is sort of applied behavioral finance going? Where do you want to take it at JP Morgan?
That's a great question. And I am excited about the future. You know, I see there are now more sort of master's programs in behavioral science. It's growing. It's being taught more. Like when we started out, there wasn't a course in it. As I said, it was years into my career to even discover. So I'm excited by the potential. I'm excited that people are starting to see the interest. And I'm excited that organizations are. Like I said, JP Morgan reached out to me for this opportunity. Where I think the challenge and opportunity is will be for us to turn like the interest in the field to something that has actual impact and is valued. Mm-hmm. And how like finding ways to implement that and measure it so that, that there's a business case to be made. Because I think once organizations like JP Morgan, big name companies, and you know there are others that are adopting this, once there's an adoption of it and a sort of proof of something, you know, there's a phrase there.
Proof of concept.
It's like once people are more broadly understand, okay, this really has impact, then I think the potential is that it's starting to happen, right? There's been organizations, both profit and nonprofit, governmental and that have had impact. But I think the more that grows, the potential will be there to do some like things that can really help people. And that's touches on my other thing that's both like a concern and an opportunity is like, making sure that this field doesn't become the latest, like how do we get people to smoke more cigarettes? I look at Thaler's his sort of three rules of ethical rules around behavioral science, and it's about the one of the six of me, like the nudge has to be for the user's best interest. Mm-hmm. And I really believe that, and I've made that case every time I speak or talked or anything about it, is like, yeah, you can trick anybody once. Like anybody can be a used car salesman and sell like clunker. Like there's, and that's not about behavioral science. That's about like whatever. Like, anybody can fool somebody. But if you really want to like build a client relationship, a long term, and I talk in like business terms, really want to make impact in someone's life, you just help them overcome their own biases. You help them get to the place that's right for them. And that's where I think we can have real impact. And a lot of times getting to the right place aligns with your business interests if it has to, or it certainly can align with your social and your community interest. So to me, the trick will be how many companies are like, oh, here's another way to sell cigarettes, or here's another way to get people into credit card debt. And how many are saying, oh, here's an opportunity to really provide value to our clients. And for those that are trying to get into the field, for them being able to distinguish the difference themselves and to work for the good causes and say no to the bad causes. So I think in the end, I think in 7 years, like this will be, I think a big number of the Fortune 500 companies will have a behavioral science mm-hmm. touch point. I think organizationally, nonprofits, I think even governments will like accept it as not a silver bullet, but an additional tool for getting policy done. There'll be some bumps along the way. You know, for those of us that are in the weeds, we see like the replicability crisis, you know, issues with noise, like there are details that we catch that will be smooth, you know, hopefully smoothed over. But I think the future is bright. And certainly the young people coming up in the field, and I'm sad I'm no longer a young person. They are very bright and enthusiastic and interested, and I'm excited to work.
Yeah. Well, I couldn't agree with you more about the direction of the field. We have people's attention. We have right. people's interest. We have people's fascination. I'm very biased, but I find it to be the most compelling and the most interesting part of finance. And I think a lot of people are in agreement with that. We can't squander that opportunity, right? We have to take right. it, measure it, be ethical about the way that we do it, and make real impact. Jeff, this has been awesome. If people want to follow your work, if they want to follow you online, if they want to buy your books, where can they find you?
Easiest starting point is Jeff Kreisler, KREISLER.com. I got a Twitter page, the Twitter Jeff Kreisler with BS at the end for behavioral science. And then I'm on all the, I don't do Instagram, but I'm on all the other social media. You can hang out around my house if you want. That'd be creepy, but I'm not going to tell you where I live. Don't hang out. Don't stalk my family. But I would love to hear from any listeners with any questions. One of my favorite things about these is getting questions, particularly questions I can't answer.
Push you in a new direction. Well, beautiful. Exactly. Thank you for your time, sir. You've been fantastic. And I know my listeners appreciate it. So thank you again.
Thank you.
Thanks for tuning in to Standard Deviations. If you can't wait till next week for more behavioral finance insights, visit www.orion.com. All opinions expressed by Dr. Daniel Crosby and podcast guests are solely their own opinions and do not reflect the opinion of or endorsement by Orion and its affiliates, subsidiaries, and employees. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as a basis for legal, tax, and investment decisions. The opinions are based upon information the participants consider reliable.